Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS recognized specialist in small animal orthopaedic surgery, Mark Morton. Thank you, Mark. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks very much, Ema. Thanks very much for joining us today. It's always good to participate in the Orthopaedic Webinar Club. I think it's becoming increasingly difficult when you go back through the list of topics to find something new to talk about. So hopefully this is just something slightly different today, having a look at some factors associated with orthopaedic problems that we see in small and toy breed dogs. There is certainly some conditions that we see exclusively in small and toy breed dogs, and we'll talk about some of those, but there's also lots of conditions that we see in dogs of all breeds and sizes, if that makes sense, that are difficult to manage in small and toy breed dogs, and hopefully there'll be some tips and tricks to treating those issues in small breed dogs. Now, like any good orthopaedic problem, we need an acronym for our talk, just to make sure we're on the right page. This is a really good example of what we're dealing with. So here's a slide of a Chihuahua and a Great Dane and their skeletons. And you can see the massive difference in the anatomy between these two breeds. And that's why some of these cases can be challenging to manage. So some of the things we see in toy breed dogs, like Perth's disease, these are associated particularly with the hip, like Perth's disease, traumatic luxations of the hip. We do see osteoarthritis in small breed dogs. We see capital physeal fractures, and whilst we don't see hip dysplasia as commonly as we do in some larger breeds, we certainly do see it. In the stifle, the two most common things you would see with small and toy breed dogs is medial patella luxations and cranial cruciate ruptures. Both of them can be challenging to manage in these little patients. And there are some things as well that are pretty uncommon in small breed dogs. So OCD lesions, as we've said, we don't see as much hip dysplasia. Bone tumours are pretty uncommon. And we don't see things like panosteitis either. So if we start with the hip as a focus for our small breed dogs, the first thing we'll talk about is like Perth's disease. It's also more commonly known as avascular necrosis of the femoral head. If you look at the literature, there's various descriptions and terminology for it over the years. Aseptic necrosis, coxaplana, it was viewed as a form of osteochondrosis. Originally, it's a non-inflammatory local ischemia, so a problem with the blood supply. It results in deformation of the femoral head and neck. You do get some revascularization following that and some healing of the bone. And it causes a variable degree of pelvic limb lameness. It's also a problem that we see in young children. Most patients presenting to us as vets be between 4 and 11 months of age. About 15% of cases will be bilateral. There are some cases that are subclinical that don't present with clinical signs, and you might identify them later because of secondary osteoarthritis and the problems that causes. Lameness can vary from mild to dogs that can be acutely non-weight bearing if there's microfractures or more severe fractures secondary to it. It's a hereditary problem in Westies, miniature poodles. As we've said, it's a problem with the blood supply. That maybe is a result of anatomic conformation, as a result of an infarction. And we see equal male to female ratios. Like Perth's disease causes necrosis of the trabecular bone of the femoral head. Secondary to that, the femoral head and neck start to fragment under loading, and it results in collapse of the epiphysis. As the body tries to resolve that issue, these are young dogs, they heal very quickly, you get secondary thickening and damage to the articular cartilage. The growth plate tends to collapse. And these patients will then start to heal themselves, but you're left with a very abnormal femoral head. One of the ways that they manage these in children, where the disease process occurs over a much longer period of time, is they try and stabilize the femoral neck. So as it naturally heals, it heals in an abnormal position. I think the changes that we see in the progression that occur in such a short, much shorter time frame in dogs, that's probably not something that we can really do. On clinical examination, you'll see a variable amount of lameness, there'll be pain on manipulation and palpation around the hip. There's quite often some crepitus as that abnormal femoral head contacts the acetabulum. And depending on how chronic this problem is, there'll be a variable degree of muscle atrophy as well. You see different types of radiographic change. So in early cases, there is increased radio opacity in the head and neck, and a focal sort of moth-eaten appearance caused by lysis of the femoral head. Later on, you start to see the femoral head and neck beginning to try to heal, so you can see resulting flattening and mottling of the femoral head where the epiphysis is collapsed. You can see collapse or thickening of the femoral neck. And in some cases, the changes can be so severe they can result in fractures to the femoral neck. Looking at these radiographically, they can look a bit like neoplastic lesions, so you get that sort of moth-eaten approach. As we said, bone tumors are pretty uncommon in small and toy breed dogs, and certainly in the age range we're talking about here, that would be very low down on our list of differentials. So here's an example of a sort of chronic case with sort of late changes. This is unilateral. So if I just grab my arrow here, this is the affected side here. You can see a pretty normal femoral head and neck over on this side, but here you can see that the femoral head has collapsed down onto the femoral neck. There's some thickening and remodeling there, and the epiphysis has almost disappeared. Just get rid of that arrow. From a treatment point of view, people have reported conservative management, so rest and analgesia. In the literature, that results in a resolution of lameness in less than 25% of cases, and certainly results in long-term osteoarthritis that generally needs to be managed. Most commonly, these cases would be managed surgically, either with a femoral head and neck excision, or more recently, a total hip replacement has become a viable option in these small dogs. I think most of these we would be managing with a femoral head and neck excision, and you can see an example of that here. So we've got the abnormal femoral head and neck on this radiograph here. And the postoperative view here, we can see our femoral head and neck excision, removing all that femoral neck and leaving no spurs. Again, here's another case of postoperative view. You can see a nice smooth femoral, a nice smooth cut going all the way down to the lesser trochanter. Some tips for performing femoral head and neck excision. We always think it's a pretty sort of straightforward procedure to do. It doesn't require a vast amount of equipment. I think the benefit of using an oscillating saw for this is great, rather than using wire. Or even rongeurs or an osteotome. I think if you're using an osteotome to do this, you're in with the risk of fracturing the femur. So I think an oscillating saw is the way to go. And we perform an osteotomy from the greater trochanter down to the calcar region, trying to preserve that lesser trochanter and the attachments of the iliopsoas. The key thing with this, and when we see dogs that aren't doing very well after a femoral head and neck excision, is to make the osteotomy perpendicular to the long axis of the femur, not perpendicular to the femoral neck. And this slide just shows an example of that. So the normal angle of inclination of the femoral neck is about 26 degrees from the neutral femoral axis. If you make a cut perpendicular to that neck, as this sort of incorrect arrow shows here, you end up with a spur on the bottom here. If you try and make your cut perpendicular to the long axis of the femur, so straight down in this direction here, you get a nice smooth edge and you don't have a sort of spur at the bottom here. The way to do that is to sort of get the alignment of the femur correct before you make your cut. So in order to do that, I would sort of align the leg with the patella pointing towards the ceiling. So the femur is sort of parallel to the floor. And then I would make my cut perpendicular to the table or perpendicular to the floor. So they're going straight down there. The alignment of the femoral neck is going to want to orientate you in this direction here. So looking at this incorrect arrow, you need to sort of keep your saw pointing down. If you do make a cut that's sort of not perfect, as soon as you can feel it when you've done it, so have a feel with your finger, you can always adjust your cut, and if you've been left with a bit of a spur down the bottom here, you can correct the cut and take that off. And you can also take all your galpies out, retractors and things, manipulate the hip in a normal position and see if you can feel any crepitus, and if there is, that's the perfect time to go back in and adjust your cut rather than further down the line when the dogs aren't doing very well. Here's an example of a case that didn't do very well following surgery and that I saw as a referral. This dog had a femoral head and neck excision, but you can see in this area here that they hadn't completely excised the femoral neck, so you're left with this spur here. Now I think that's probably not due to the position that the cut was made in, it's probably due to simply not taking enough bone, and the dog was uncomfortable when you manipulated the hip. It lost a fair amount of muscle, as you can see from the x-ray, because it hadn't used the leg for a long period of time, and we revised that surgery, revised the femoral head and neck excision, and the dog did pretty well afterwards. Back to the x-ray that we saw before, that's what you're aiming for, a nice smooth cut with no spurs that minimises the chance of irritation to the acetabulum. Total hip replacement is a viable option in these patients now. We do not very many compared to large breed dogs, but with the advent of small implants, it's become a much more reasonable thing to consider. Probably 5-10 years ago, it wouldn't be on the things that we would be discussing with owners presenting with this issue. The question is whether we should do that or not. There are some studies reporting excellent outcomes in small breed dogs. We use the biometric cemented system here. There are more complications with small breed dogs, and we'll discuss those in detail a little bit further on in the talk. Hip dysplasia is a pretty uncommon problem in small breed dogs, but we certainly still see it. The pathogenesis is similar to large breed dogs, and treatment options are the same. Medical management, conservative management, that's probably beyond the scope of this talk, really. But the surgical salvage options are femoral head and neck excision or a total hip replacement. Historically, as we said, like Perth disease, we would probably, for these smaller dogs, think that femoral head and neck excision was the more appropriate procedure. But there has been some work questioning actually how well dogs do. We always sort of tend to say that small breed dogs and cats do pretty well after a femoral head and neck excision. But there was a study published historically in the German literature, but reprinted in ReCut a few years ago, that assessed the outcomes following a femoral head and neck excision. So vet assessed outcomes following femoral head and neck excision in the study by Off and Mattis showed a good outcome in 38% of cases, a satisfactory outcome in about 20% of cases, but a poor outcome in 42% of cases. However, 96% of owners were satisfied with how well their dogs were doing after surgery. So whether that relates to owner expectations not being high enough, it's possible that some of these dogs that we do femoral head and neck excisions would do better with a total hip replacement. It is possible to convert a femoral head and neck excision to a total hip replacement, and Bill Liske reported that in a cat. So it may be that as time goes on, we do more total hip replacements rather than femoral head and neck excisions in these small breed patients, and that will probably become the gold standard option. Here's an example of a small dog with bilateral hip dysplasia and marked subluxation of both femoral heads. And we treated that case with a total hip replacement. So this is a micro hip from Biomedrics. There's a few studies looking at the outcomes in small dogs and cats, and the outcomes are pretty good. The indications for total hip replacements in small breed dogs, if you look at Marino's paper, 66% of cases had a total hip replacement as a result of osteoarthritis. About 17% of the dogs had a hip replacement to treat a luxation of the hip. About 2% were due to a capital physeal fracture. The other 15% were leg perthes, as we talked about earlier on. Complications reported across the studies in small breed dogs run at about 10 to 12%, so probably a little bit higher than the commonly quoted 10% we see in larger breed dogs that most of the early studies were based on or performed on before we had implants that were small enough for these little guys. Moving on to the stifle. So the two big things we see in the stifle of causing lameness in the stifle of small breed dogs, medial patellar luxation would be the big one, and of course craniocruciate ligament ruptures. And both of those things can of course occur together. So to start with patellar luxation, sort of not going back to the basics too much, but of course patellar luxation is displacement of the patella from the trochlear sulcus. That's medial in about 70 to 80% of cases, and it tends to be medial in almost all these small and toy breed dogs. We see many more lateral luxations in the larger breed dogs. It's bilateral in 20 to 25% of cases. These dogs often present with a history of sudden onset lameness while running. They can be non-weight bearing for a short period of time before returning to normal. That classically described skipping gait. Patellar luxation can range from an incidental finding to being severe enough to cause a non-weight bearing lameness. In dogs that have bilateral disease, they can have a crouch stance and a real reluctance to walk. There's four clinical populations that present with patellar luxations. We see puppies with severe deformities and gait abnormalities causing medial patellar luxation. The most common population, I would say, presenting here would be the young sort of mature dog with an intermittent and progressive lameness or skipping gait that's beginning to affect their activity levels or being noticed more frequently by the owner. We see an older population of dogs with a persistent lameness due to patellochondromalacia and osteoarthritis. That patella has been popping in and out over the course of the dog's life. It starts to then cause them trouble. So it's really the osteoarthritis that's the issue rather than the patellar luxation that they probably had all their life. We also see this population of dogs that have an acute onset lameness where they either get a patellar luxation secondary to craniocruciate ligament rupture or the low grade patellar luxation is made worse following the rupture of the craniocruciate ligament. Again, we'll talk about this in the next few slides on cruciates, but as well as stopping the tibia moving forwards and backwards, the cruciate ligament also stops internal rotation of the tibia. So when you rupture your cruciate, the tendency is, particularly in these small breed dogs, I would say, for the tibia to rotate internally, taking the tibial tuberosity and the patella with it, and that can either cause a patellar luxation in a dog that didn't have one before, or make a pre-existing patellar luxation worse. So there's the classically described grading system for patellar luxations, grade 1 to 4. Grade 1 would be an intermittent luxation so the patella sits in the sulcus most of the time, but luxates usually at full extension, or can be reduced manually, but always goes straight back in again. There's often no crepitus. a grade 2, again an intermittent luxation, but more frequently grade 1. It's easy to manually luxate the patella on extension and flexion of the stifle. Sometimes the patella will go back in on its own, but it may need manual reduction. Grade 3, the patella is luxated medially most of the time. It can be reduced manually, but pops back out again. And grade 4, the patella is permanently luxated and can't be reduced. These are the descriptors of these grades, sort of pretty common across the literature, but I don't really base too much on yes, it's a grade 3, it must have surgery. Yes, it's a grade 4, it must have surgery. I would use the grading system to describe the problem to colleagues or in clinical notes, but base the need for surgery, for example, on clinical presentation. So as we know, patella luxation is caused by a malalignment of the quadriceps mechanism, secondary to lateral bowing of the distal third of the femur. Again, you can see here a bit more focus on the stifle in the normal knee. The kneecap would run up and down in the sulcus. In an affected dog, because of the distal femoral varus, the malalignment of the quadriceps mechanism causes the patella to sort of drift medially. So when do we operate? Well, age is always a consideration. I tend to get dogs towards skeletal maturity if possible, so 8-9 months of age. I think there is a concern with causing growth disturbance, operating too young. One of the issues when you do a tibial tuberosity transposition, if you move the tuberosity and pin it back on in a very young dog, as they continue to grow and their tibial lengthens from the proximal physis, you can end up with the tuberosity ending up a long way down the tibia. So depending on how affected dogs are, I would wait till they were sort of 8-9 months of age and were approaching skeletal maturity. Level of lameness is always a consideration. There is loads of dogs running about with low-grade patella luxations that have never had a problem in their life, and the patella luxations picked up because the dogs are assessed for another reason. I think to operate on a patella luxation, it needs to be causing lameness. Crepitus is a good thing to evaluate. Whilst there's no literature that says dogs do terribly long term if you don't operate on a patella luxation, logic would suggest that the more cartilage and things you lose from repeated luxation and reduction of a patella, the more issues a dog may have long term. And certainly with concurrent disease like a cruciate rupture, I tend to correct the patella luxation at the same time. So management of patella luxation, again, that's not the sort of particular area of this talk, but applying this to small breed dogs can be difficult. So there's several things that we do, and I tend to do most of these in all cases, to be honest. So in the case of a medial patella luxation, a lateral tibial tuberosity transposition, a trochlear sulcoplasty, a medial capsular release, and then lateral implication of the soft tissues. And in very persistent cases where it's difficult to get the patella to track normally and stop luxating, my sort of final approach would be a suture from the fibula to the patella ligament on the lateral side, just to sort of keep that patella tracking normally. Major corrective osteotomies are rarely performed, certainly by me and the place where I've worked. We've got more information and data on those in the literature, and it might be that something we do more of going forwards. Following surgery, across the literature, reluxation rates range from about 8 to 11%. There's a good study by Gareth Arthurs looking at the effect of each of these procedures on the rate of reluxation. Tibial tuberosity transposition is protective. So when performing a tibial tuberosity transposition, reluxation rates are about 6% compared to about 25% when you don't perform that. Again, a sulcoplasty is protective, so relaxation rate's again about 6% compared to about 21% if you don't perform it. And overall complication rates in the Arthur study with treatment of medial patellar luxations was about 18%. There's another study where they didn't do sulcoplasty at all by Linney. The overall complication rate in that study was about 34%. One of the big questions when you do a sulcoplasty is whether to do a wedge or a block. Now, I tend to do a block in almost all cases. In these toy breed dogs, it is certainly more difficult, and really, really small dogs would be probably the one exception to doing this. I think most dogs you can do a block recession, but you need to be much more careful with the trochlear ridges that you don't cause a fracture. The most important point of the sulcus is the proximal entry point and the depth at that area, because your sulcus can be as deep as you want down the middle, but if the patella is already luxated, it's useless because the patella is not running in there. Once the patella engages with the groove initially, it will normally track normally down the middle without luxation. So you normally get the luxation occurring at the beginning of flexion, if that makes sense. A block recession, as you can see over here, allows you to increase the depth of the sulcus more proximally compared to a block. So here you can see a block versus a wedge. There's the cross section of it there, and that's the effect it has proximally. So a wedge, you sort of taper it off at the top, and you never get it quite as deep as at the top as you do with a block. So for me, I would do a block in most cases. Tubal tuberosity transposition, so you can use I tend to use a finger saw, particularly in these very small breed dogs. I know some people in very little dogs will use bone cutters to do that. So you sort of protect the patella ligament, go down the front of the tubal tuberosity and release it. I think it's really important, if you can, to preserve an attachment at the bottom, which I think helps to minimise avulsion afterwards. Here's an image of a typical tuberosity transposition. So the tuberosity has been released here, and we're using some rongeurs just to make a little bed for the tuberosity to sit on laterally. And then we'd secure that in position with some KYs and a tension band. With regard to these little dogs, fixation can be difficult because of their size. So do you try and get one pin, two pins, plus or minus a tension band? Well, we always talk about having two pins, one to sort of hold the tuberosity in position, and a second pin to minimise rotation. I think if the dog's big enough to get two pins in, I would certainly try and do that. But there's plenty of these little dogs where I will just put one pin in. I will try and maintain an attachment to the tuberosity distally, and I will always put a tension band in to help with that fixation. For me, a tension band and one pin is much better than getting two pins in. So just to show you a sort of case example here, this is a two-year-old chihuahua presenting with a skipping lameness, had a grade 2 medial patellar luxation in its left pelvic limb. Here's the x-ray of its sort of normal right leg. If you compare that to the left here, you can see there is a bit of bowing of the femur, some varus. And on this x-ray, you can see that the patella is medially positioned. Now, I would take that with a bit of a pinch of salt, particularly if you view it the other way around. If you look at the normal right leg here, that x-ray shows the patella is sitting normally. I think you can position the patella where you want by taking a perfectly straight x-ray. So whilst an x-ray showing that the patella is medially positioned out of the sulcus is sort of diagnostic that this dog will have a patella luxation, the fact that your patella is sitting normally doesn't mean that it hasn't got a medial patella luxation, if that makes sense. The degree of femoral varus is also something to assess carefully. You need perfectly straight x-rays to assess this. any rotation of the femur, like we see here, and you can make it look significantly worse. And I'll show you a good example of that, comparing it to the post-op of this leg. So in this dog, we did a block recession sulcoplasty. You can see where the block's been removed here. You can see the patella sitting normally in the sulcus. Again, I wouldn't sort of take the post-op that the patella's in a normal position as my final assessment of whether I resolve the problem. That's done clinically as to whether the kneecap still looks eight or not. In this dog, we used one pin and a tension band. You can see that on the lateral as well. And just as a comparison, if you look at this preoperative x-ray here of the left leg, this is the same dog. You can see what looks like a much more significant femoral varus than compared to the post-op x-ray. Now, the only thing that's different in the femur compared to these two x-rays is the position. So the post-op is perfectly straight. You can see the femoral condyle sitting there, whereas the pre-op is rotated. So if you are assessing femoral varus, you need perfectly straight x-rays. So cruciate disease, again, we're not going to go back to the start too much and talk about cruciate in great detail, but how do we apply our treatment options for cruciate ruptures to our small breed dogs? Are they just like big dogs? Well, in these patients, I would say you quite often see them presenting with chronic disease, so an insidious lameness that's grumbled on for a long period of time. Owners will often report a recent deterioration when you question them, and that is often associated with a meniscal tear. In these little dogs, I don't think it's uncommon to see advanced arthritis at the time of presentation. These cruciate ruptures, like most dogs, are almost always degenerative. It's very rare to see a true traumatic rupture, and they may have medial patellar luxation as a concurrent problem secondary to rupturing that ligament. Assessing stability, well, again, we're not going to talk about how you diagnose a cruciate rupture in too much detail, but we'll all be familiar in the orthopedic club with cranial draw and tibial thrust. The one thing I would say with small breed dogs is that I will diagnose cruciates in larger dogs almost always with a tibial thrust. It's very rare for me to do a cranial draw. Little dogs are the exception to that. I think cranial draw is a bit more reliable. Often these small dogs have quite a steep tibial plateau, and the tibia is often cranially displaced at the time of examination. So they may have no tibial thrust because the tibia is already cranially displaced. So when you're trying to do a cranial draw, you almost need to do a caudal draw and reposition the tibia in a normal position before you can feel it. And to get a tibial thrust, you sometimes need to reposition the tibia either with pressure from your finger or a caudal draw before you try and feel that. Just to sort of jump back to that one, if you look at x-rays of these small breed dogs at the time of surgery, their tibia is often sitting in a cranial position, so the femur is sitting off the back of it, and that's what happens when you examine them, and which is why they quite often don't have a tibial thrust that you can feel readily without doing something first. Radiographic signs in small breed dogs exactly the same as the rest of these patients, so they'll have a stifle effusion. You'll be familiar with the fat pad sign, where at the front of the stifle we lose, let me get my arrow up, we lose our normal dark black triangle of fat, and it's replaced by this effusion. I would say you see less of an effusion in small breed dogs than you do in large breed dogs, not simply because they're smaller, of course. You can see a little bit of bulge at the back of the joint due to effusion and displacement of this fascial plane. And you see osteophytes in all the common places, so up on the trochlear ridges, distal pole of the patella, and around the faveli, and at the insertion of the cruciate ligament. And often in these small breed dogs, as we said, you will see cranial displacement of the tibia. So conservative management has been reported in small breed dogs up to about 10-15 kilos in weight. It's quite an old study. I think if you were managing a dog conservatively now, there'd be a bigger emphasis on physiotherapy and rehabilitation. Ideally, We would have strict cage rest for 6 to 8 weeks, some non-steroidals for a varying amount of time depending on how the dog's doing. And what we're relying on with conservative management is getting enough fibrosis to stabilize the joint. Reports of using stifle braces, again, that gets tricky in these very small dogs. And after sort of 6 to 8 weeks, I would normally reassess these patients and then start a gradual build-up in exercise from there. Now, whether you're doing conservative management because of the age of the patient, for economic reasons, for their size, it can be effective, but I would always warn the owners that they need to be pretty strict with it if it's going to work, and there's a real chance that it won't be successful. And I do tend to recommend surgical intervention in these small breed dogs. So surgery, so what technique are we going to use? Well, meniscal tears are still common in small breed dogs, and I'll do an arthrotomy in all these patients to check the meniscus. And then which technique? Well, you know, historically, we would say, well, you know, it's a little dog, it doesn't need an osteotomy, a TPLO. TTAs are much more difficult and are limited by the size of implants in small breed dogs. But TPLO and cranial closing wedges are appropriate. I think there are some reasons why they are appropriate to these small breed dogs. Of course, the technique that's most appropriate for a patient is the one that the surgeon is most familiar with. I certainly wouldn't try a TPLO for the first time on a little patient. I would stick with a lateral suture if that's not something that you're familiar with. So just a few sort of pointers around lateral sutures. So sort of there's lots of questions and people will have their own opinions and ways of doing these things, but there's a wide choice of material. I tend to use nylon leader line stabilized with a crimp. Where do you put your tunnel? Well, there's lots of papers looking at that and talk of isometric points, which we'll come on to in a second. You would need secure placement around the fibula or attachment to the femoral condyle with a suture anchor. What position do you have the joint in when you tighten it? How tight should it be? And how should that be secured, either with a knot or a crimp? So isometric points refer to the suture maintaining its tension throughout a range of motion. So the point isometric points are two points or anchor positions that will remain the same distance apart throughout that range of motion. So the tension in the suture shouldn't change as the dog flex and extend and stifle. And ideally to do that, they would mimic normal anatomy. There's various studies looking at positions of sutures in cats and in small dogs. This is a study by Fisher, and none of the positions they looked at are combinations resulted in constant tension of the suture throughout a range of motion. The best positions that they had, or the closest to isometric in this particular study, was around the fibula, and then two holes through the tibia rather than passing or suture underneath the patellar ligament. And then what the one thing that sort of came out of this study is that you should tension the suture with the stifle at about 100 degrees. If you do it at about 70 degrees, so more flexion, that resulted in loosening as you flexed and extended the stifle. So here's an example of a cruciate rupture in a Jack Russell that we treated with a lateral suture. Now, this actually is a good example of what we were talking about before, so the sort of cranial displacement of the tibia. So you can see here that the femoral condyles are sat off the back of the tibial plateau. So if you try to do a tibial thrust in this dog, the tibia is already sat in a thrust position, if that makes sense. So you need to reduce the tibia back before you would get a thrust, and the same goes for trying to get a cranial draw. We did an arthrotomy here. It's not the best image to see, but I really show this as an example of how tricky it can be to look into these joints. You need two pairs of joint distractors to really get a good view. The biggest sort of speed lock ones that I'd be more familiar with using are too big for these patients, so the small sort of Galby type ones is what I would advise. Uh, So you can see here, we would close the arthrotomy. I would close the arthrotomy before placing the suture because it's tricky to do. I would tend to do a lateral arthrotomy with a lateral suture. I think if you can get a reasonable view of the medial meniscus, it is easier to check the medial meniscus through a medial arthrotomy. If I was going to do that whilst doing a lateral suture, I would make a lateral approach, flip the skin incision around and do a medial arthrotomy rather than trying to do place a lateral suture via a medial skin approach, which is really tricky to get the incision in the correct place. We use nylon leader line and a metal crimp in this patient. Now you can see our post-op x-rays. See a hole in the tuber in the tibia here. Ideally, that would be placed over it more cranially, sort of in this area here. And as we talked about earlier, that Fisher study shows that two holes is probably preferable now to one. In one, you would loop the suture back underneath the patellar ligament, so it would be more isometric to have two holes rather than the loop going up around the back of the patellar ligament. Overall, if you look at the literature, there's a 17% complication rate with lateral sutures and about 4 to 6% infection rate, depending on what you do. So a few years ago, there was a sort of newish type implant variation called tightrope. It's a variation of a lateral suture. It's made by a company called Arthrex using a fiber wire tape. Or fiber tape as it's called, sorry. It was marked as a sort of quick and simple procedure to do. If you've done a few, you can sort of accurately position your tunnels, but it isn't always that straightforward to start with. The fiber tape is placed through a drill tunnel across the femoral condyle and then one through the tibia. There's a little anchor on one end of that tape and a button to tie the other end round. Everything sort of comes in the kit. So you need minimal extra equipment other than a drill. And initial reports were that the outcomes were similar to TPLO. There was a high rate of infection reported anecdotally with these cases, and I think you're always going to get that when you're placing a braided material into patients. I don't know that many people who still do tight ropes as a routine procedure, but I thought that was something you would certainly hear about. So worth mentioning, I would still stick with the traditional type lateral suture using nylon leader line around the fibula and through one or two holes in the tibia. So TPLO, tibial plateau leveling osteotomy. Again, I'm not going to be talking too much detail about TPLOs, but sort of how and why this may be applicable to our small breed patients. I tend to treat most dogs I see with a TPLO, and I think TPLO is now particularly appropriate to small breed dogs because they tend to have a particularly steep tibial plateau. So why not just do a lateral suture? Well, certainly it can be effective. I've treated many dogs with lateral sutures successfully. Trying to get isometric positioning is not easy, and I'm sure we've all had lateral sutures that have loosened prematurely and the surgery has failed as a result. TPLO is a very viable option in small breed dogs because with sort of newer implants, so smaller implants, so 2.0 and 2.4 millimeter screws and associated plates. And also I think locking technology in the plates has made a massive difference to how well these dogs do. Cruciate ruptures in these little dogs are often quite chronic and there's marked cranial displacement of the tibia. Because the tibial plateau is frequently much steeper than in larger breed dogs, and if you look at studies looking at TPLO in small breed dogs, you know, average plateau angles are 37, 38. Some of those did focus on small breed dogs with excessive tibial plateaus, but 32 in Vanini's paper, probably compared to more like 24, 27 in bigger dogs. It is challenging and technically demanding to do a TPLO in a small breed dog. we sort of often joke that we probably wouldn't do it unless they did so well. They often have a very steep tibial plateau. There were historically concerns about how far you could rotate the tibial plateau past what we called the safe point, which was the insertion of the patellar ligament. There are numerous studies now that have shown we can probably rotate it a bit further than we thought we could, and that's less of a concern. It's possible to combine a TPLO with a cranial closing wedge in a very steep, if you have a very steep plateau angle. So if you feel that you can't rotate the plateau far enough, you can combine it with a closing wedge. Blade selection is important. So in lots of these little dogs, we'd be using the smallest blade that's available, which is a 12mm blade. And between manufacturers, the thickness of the blade varies a lot. So my preference would be the sort of synthes blade, which is very thin and minimizes how much bone you're removing, which can make a difference in these little patients. For me, the synthes locking plate has made a big difference. So this, the x-ray on the left there shows the old Slocum style plate that we used to use. Now, in these little dogs where you're rotating the plateau a reasonable distance, you tend to end up with a pretty large overhang at the back. And positioning a normal shaped TPLO plate that has this sort of third screw in the nose of the plate, if you will, can be difficult because you end up with the plate angled so that the distal end of the plate is angled very cranially. You can sometimes struggle to get these screws into the caudal cortex because of the angle. What I used to do historically was to use the plate for the opposite leg, so the nose sort of pointed backwards, and that made it a little bit easier to fit on. When synthes designed their small locking plate, they actually designed the shape of the plate so that extra screw hole sat caudally and could pick up all this bone at the back. It's a locking plate, and this metaphyseal bulldog there, and I think the locking screws make a massive difference. This slide really just illustrates the size of these patients. So here you can see our approach to perform a TPLO. We've got the locking drill guide into the plate here. Just there underneath the tip of my arrow, you can see the osteotomy. I think there's one more slide. Okay, so this view from the side. So you can see that needle is sort of in the joint space between the femoral condyle and the tibial plateau. The osteotomy is just there. So you're working in a pretty tight area. There's not much room to get these plates on, which is one of the reasons why it makes it challenging. So if you compare this postoperative x-ray to the one we saw before, the shaft of the plate sits much more in the middle of the tibia. And the sort of nose of the plate is pointing caudally, picking up all this bone here. The other good thing about this plate is that the screw holes are angled. So in a normal bone plate, your screw holes would be perpendicular to the surface of the plate. But since he's cleverly designed this, so the screw holes are angled. So if you imagine these screw holes for the locking screws are perpendicular to the plate, we'd be angled in that direction there. So historically, we would angle our drill across here towards the fibula head. It's much easier to avoid the joint with these locking plates with the pre-directed holes. Again, another example of the plate here on a post-operative x-ray, so you can see our cut. You can see the plate sat here. And you can see the screws perpendicular to the screws in the shaft, even though the plate is pre-contoured to go around the top of the tibia. So we often see concurrent medial patellar luxation with these little dogs. And it can always be a question of sort of what's causing the lameness. Well, for me, in a dog with an acute onset lameness, it's the cruciate that's the problem. Yes, a patellar luxation can be made worse by rupturing a cruciate, as we talked about, but the dog's had a patellar luxation most of its life. It's a developmental condition, so I tend to treat the cruciate rupture and the patella at the same time. in most of these cases, but I think the cruciate's really the priority. So here's an example here. This dog had a cruciate rupture and a medial patella luxation. And when performing a TPLO, there's a really nice technique that I've done with colleagues a number of times and was recently reported by Leonard, where you perform a TPLO as normal, but once you've fixed your plateau in its normal position, you can then do a tibial tuberosity transposition, take the tuberosity off and move it more laterally. You can also do your sulcoplasty at the same time. And here you can see the tibia has had a TPLO performed. This is an old tight plate sat here. But then we've made another osteotomy down front of the tuberosity and fixed it in place with two K wires and a tension band. In Leonard's paper, there was no reluxations reported with that technique. So what do we do in these dogs with a very steep tibial plateau? Well, here's an example here. You can see a really steep tibial plateau. This is probably secondary to a historic physeal fracture. The femoral condyles are sat right off the back of the tibia. Trying to treat this simply with a TPLO would be very difficult because the amount of rotation that you would need would result with the sort of proximal section of the tibia sat right back out here and a lot of load on what remained of the tuberosity, increasing the risk of fracture. So Slocum and Devine actually before they talked about TPLO with a circular cut and talked about a cranial closing wedge where you cut a triangle of bone out of the tibia, you fix it with a TPLO plate and some pins. The technique was modified by Wallace, particularly to small breed dogs, which allowed sort of make your wedge is incomplete, and it results in less shortening of the tibia and a smaller wedge, and also more bone stock for your implants. So sort of moving on for this from the stifle, just some things that we might see in the thoracic limb. So antibrachial deformities are common in small breed dogs, and they can be secondary to physeal trauma or genetic dysplasia, so a sort of exaggeration of normal conformation. Physeal injury is a common cause. So the distal ulnar physis is the source of about 60% of all physeal injuries. There are a few reasons for that. So it's responsible for 100% of ulnar growth, and it has a conical shape to increase its surface area, as you can see here, compared to most growth plates, which are flat. If you have an injury to any other growth plate, shear tends to cause displacement. And a sort of physeal fracture, as you would commonly see. What happens in the distal ulnar physis is the conical shape converts that shear into compression. So there's nowhere for the sort of bone above the physis to go because it's locked in by this conical shape. So the growth plate is compressed, which causes premature closure. Now, because the radius and ulna is a paired bone system, they need to grow at a similar rate in order for the leg to remain straight. So what happens when you get premature closure of the distal ulna physis is shown on the next slide. So we get this classic picture. It's our friend here. And if we look at that radiographically, what's resulted from premature closure of the distal ulnar physis, as you can see here, is this radius curvus, some torsion of the leg, humeral ulnar subluxation, torsion of the antebrachium, and the big one that you can see in the picture, carpal valgus. So there are some cases that require sort of invasive corrective osteotomies. Again, that's a bit beyond the scope of this talk. When I assess these dogs, It can be sometimes tricky to decide whether you need to go down the route of an invasive corrective osteotomy using ring fixators or not. There's certainly an aesthetic to a dog having a straight leg, but it can often be difficult to put that to function. Lots of these dogs, their major issue when they have an antebrachial deformity is elbow and carpal pain. And they get their elbow pain because of this humeral ulnar incongruity. And the way that we treat that is with a proximal ulnar osteotomy. So we make an angled cut across the proximal ulnar, and the pull of the triceps brings the proximal section higher and improves the conformation under load. It's important to make that cut above the interosseous muscle, as if you make it too low, that can restrict how much this proximal section can move, and it doesn't improve the congruity of the elbow as much as we would like. There's another case here. This one has had an ulnar osteotomy that's been supported with an IM pin. And at 7 weeks, you can see that's beginning to heal, and you can see that the congruity of the elbow has been maintained. Historically, one of the issues and the reasons why people put IM pins in was because when you made this angled cut, it was very easy, or not uncommonly, you got displacement of this proximal section. So the proximal section moved proximally, but then you got some caudal rotation, and that resulted in malunions. Putting a pin down the middle stops that caudal rotation, but there is some thinking that it can limit how much the proximal section can then move proximally. So more recently, a bioblique osteotomy has been described, which allows the proximal part of the ulna to move proximally, but limits the caudal rotation. And that was described by Fitzpatrick. And essentially, you make as long an oblique osteotomy as you can, starting laterally, caudally, and proximally, going to distally, cranially, and medially. And that limits the rotation. Here's an example of an x-ray from a colleague. You need to be very careful doing ulnar osteotomies. You need to make an approach, and you do need to protect the radius, because it's very easy to continue your osteotomy into the radius. That dog is very close to fracturing its radius, so that surgery was revised and some stabilization of plate and screws was put on its radius. As I say, it's a bit beyond this talk to go into corrective osteotomies in detail and how we assess and treat those. But here's an example of a dog with a severe antebrachial deformity. So this dog was treated with a corrective osteotomy and a ring fixator was placed, and gradually that limb was lengthened and positioned normally. A few other things we see in the thoracic limbs. So congenital elbow luxation is a six-month-old chihuahua here. Type 2 congenital luxation is the most common. It's a developmental luxation of the ulna. It's non-traumatic. We see it in Yorkies, Chihuahuas, Pomeranians, Pugs. And it's noted at birth or shortly after. These dogs have a very characteristic presentation. They present with partial flexion and internal rotation of the antebrachium. Radiographically, you tend to see craniolateral rotation of the ulna, a sort of very small, narrow radial head that doesn't form properly because it's not articulating normally with the humeral condyle. It can be treated conservative if there's no pain and dogs have good function, but often these dogs will need intervention because they really struggle to walk. In very young dogs, it's possible to try and reduce the elbow closed and then stabilize it for up to 4 months of age. However, in some of these cases, and in slightly older dogs, open reduction is required, followed by stabilization, either with an external fixator or a transarticular pin has been reported from the ulna to the humerus. both of those, either close reduction or open reduction, would need immobilisation for a period of time afterwards. So there's the cranial x-ray just showing you for this evening. Type 1 is less common, but that's a sort of developmental luxation of the radius. It's mainly reported in larger breed dogs as they grow, bulldogs. It has been reported in a Yorkshire Terrier. Lots of these dogs can cope reasonably well. This is a pretty severe case, but I would tend to manage these conservatively if they're mildly affected. It's possible to try and improve the congruity of the elbow with various techniques, distraction with a ring fixator and positioning, gradual repositioning of the radial head is reported. One of the problems is, unless you're treating these dogs at a very young age, is that the radial head is malformed and doesn't articulate properly with the humeral condyle when you place it back into its normal position. So when you're doing, if you're doing things like a corrective osteotomy in these, you can sometimes make the dogs actually more uncomfortable because they've got an abnormal articulation between the humeral condyle and the radial head. In very severe cases, Aldo Vizzoni has reported some good results with an excision of the radial head to improve comfort, though function is not perfect following that. Another thing we may see in particularly Daxies is something called Pes varus, which is caused by eccentric closure of the medial portion of the distal tibial physis. You can see probably that last image shows best a sort of varus of the tibia causing that axial positioning of the foot. Radiographically, this is what it looks like. So you can see the normal left leg here and this severe varus of the distal tibia. So here's another example. We treat those with a corrective osteotomy. So we do what's called an opening wedge. So measuring the angle and the position of the location of the deformity, we cut a wedge or make an osteotomy, a cut in the bone and open up that lateral side of the tibia. We then fix it with a plate and some screws and apply a bone graft in the middle. That's an x-ray at 6 weeks showing it healing, and there at 14 weeks approaching complete union. It can be difficult managing these with the bone stock you have distal to your osteotomy and opening wedge. So T-plates can be useful, and again, I think locking implants have made a difference to implant security. The sort of whistle-stop tour of things you might see, craniomandibular osteopathy, can be a unilateral or bilateral problem that we see, particularly in Westies. It results in an osseous proliferation around the mandibles and the bully. Normal bone marrow is replaced by a sort of vascular, fibrous type tissue. Clinical signs vary a lot, from mild difficulty prehending and chewing and some discomfort to complete inability to open the mouth. Some of these dogs are severely affected and are unable to eat or drink. Hypersalivation is also reported, depression. Some of these dogs can be so severely affected they need feeding tubes placed. There's discomfort on palpation and attempted opening and closing of the mouth. Typically, these dogs will present at 4 to 10 months of age. It's a non-inflammatory, non-neoplastic condition. It's an inherited problem in Westies. Early treatment is symptomatic. Analgesia. Feeding, if necessary, feeding tubes in the most severe cases, liquid diets. Long-term, even when these dogs have recovered, the bone that's produced may interfere with function of the TMJ. Severe cases are reported to be managed by hemimandibulectomies, though I've never done that. If you excise the bone during the active period of disease, it often recurs. it can affect long bones as well. So here's an example of a four-month-old Westie with cranium mandibular osteopathy that also has a proliferative lesion affecting its ulna. Little miniature poodle in its thoracic limb. This dog has congenital luxation of the shoulder. This affects lots of different small and toy breed dogs. I think poodles, large apsos would be the one I'd have most commonly seen it in. It's a form of glenoid dysplasia. They often present 3 to 10 months of age with no report of trauma, or certainly sort of mild trauma, not the high level of trauma you would normally expect with a shoulder luxation. They present with the elbow flexed and adducted, the distal limb abducted. In dogs that are severely affected, conservative management often results in poor outcomes, and really treatment for these patients is an excision of the glenoid or an arthrodesis of the shoulder. You do sometimes see this as an incidental finding in the more mild cases where dogs have learned to cope with their disability. So just sort of show you that's the same case. And if you just sort of compare that to a traumatic luxation, you can see in this congenital luxation this how abnormal the glenoid is. So in this dog, so I can get my arrow back down here. There we go. The glenoid is almost flat here and here, and the humeral head isn't as convex as it should be. Compare that to a traumatic luxation. I think this was a Labrador that had been hit by a car. You can see a much more normal glenoid, and you can see a much more rounded humeral head. So we'll try and skip through as much of these as we can before the end of the talk. Cavaliers, not uncommon to present with elbow pain, as well as Springer Spaniels and Cocker Spaniels. We do see humeral intracondylar fissures in Cavaliers, and that would always be on my list of differentials for elbow pain and intermittent lameness in a Cavalier. You can see that radiographically, as you see here. Gold standard way to diagnose that would be with a CT scan, and equally you can see that on an MRI. Historically, this was called incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle, because we thought that this was a persistent growth plate. We now know that it's more likely to be a type of stress fracture. There probably is a population of dogs that have a true incomplete ossification, and they're the sort of young dogs that present as puppies, sometimes with lameness, more commonly with lateral condylar fractures. Treatment for a human with a condylar fissure is a transcondylar screw. We can put these in, sort of vary them in size, obviously depending on the patient, but you still want to get the biggest screw in that you can, because we don't think that these fissures heal and that screw is subject to loading, and we do see fatigue failure. Secondary to a humeral intracondylar fissure or incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle in some of these young puppies, lateral and medial epicondylar fractures are not uncommon in small dogs. Here's an example of a Tibetan Terrier with a medial epicondylar fracture. It's been stabilised with a transcondylar screw. A wash has been placed. The screw's been placed in leg fashion, and one of the issues in these very small dogs is as you tighten the screw, the screw can just sort of carry on compressing into the soft bone, so a washer minimises that. This dog was so small, it wasn't possible to plate it. That would normally be my preference. So we've placed a pin up the medial epicondylar ridge in this case. And there's a few studies that show plating has less complications than pinning. I think in these very young dogs that we know are going to heal very quickly, pinning is fine and minimises the effect on growth going forwards. This is a 12-week-old the Yorkie that I saw with a condylar fracture, and this was particularly challenging because of its size and how soft the bone was. So getting implants into this dog was a concern. There really wasn't much room for a transcondylar screw, let alone pins or plates on the epicondylar ridges. So a technique reported by Bruno Pironi and Aldo Vizzoni involves simply treating these with K-wires pins. So you place a transcondylar K-wire once you've reduced the fracture. And then again, in this case, this was a medial fracture, so there's two pins up the medial epicondylar ridge. They reported a case series of 35 cases, 31 out of 35 made a full recovery. Three had a reduced range of motion, and one dog had a grade 1 lameness and some crepes in the joint. Eight of the 35 dogs had what was reported as a major complication, but they were all related to loosening of those implants, and all those issues resolved once the implants had been removed, and there was no OA reported in long-term follow-up of those cases. So whereas in most dogs I would be trying to put a transcondylar screw in and ideally a plate, in these very little dogs with very soft bone, simply pinning them is a pretty good option. This is the 6-week follow-up of that case, so you can I didn't take these x-rays, they were sent to me, but slightly rotated view here, but the fracture of his healed completely, and this dog had no problems with his implants and they were left in situ long term. So the other thing that we see in Cavaliers is colenoid disease. So despite it being a small breed dog, it's always a differential for a thoracic limb lameness. So you can see here hyperattenuation. This cross-section of the radius ulna, hypoattenuation of the medial colenoid process, and some fragmentation on that view there. And so the last thing that we're going to just sort of skip over is probably the one that springs to mind most with toy breed dogs, and that's radius ulna fractures. And you can see our little friend here, the Italian Greyhound. Radius ulnar fractures in these small breed dogs occur normally somewhere between a sixth and a third of the distal length. In larger dogs, you more often get hyperextension injuries to the carpus. They're a problem because there's a high rate of complications reported with radius ulnar fractures in toy breed dogs, and that results from some of the things here. So Brianza showed that the antibrachial toy breed dogs are more susceptible to fractures to start with due to the morphological differences. The radius isn't just smaller because it's a smaller dog, but the cortices are also thinner. There's also some differences in the blood supply. So Welsh showed that reduced intraosseous blood supply from the nutrient artery was present in these toy breed dogs. So you can see a larger 30 kilogram dog at the bottom here has a broad branching supply from the nutrient artery. This is the epiphysis of the radius. You can see in this toy breed dog at the top, the nutrient artery comes down, but there is significantly less branching and spread of that blood supply. This is a cadaver study using India ink to show where the blood supply goes. And this change in the blood supply, or this difference in the blood supply, is at the metaphyseal-diaphyseal junction in the same area where these fractures occur. So one of the reasons we may get a delay in healing is because of a reduced blood supply. Here's just a few slides showing complications that you can get with non-unions in these cases. Here's a case example to show you. This is quite a nice one because it's sort of higher than normal. You can, in some of these patients, be left with very small fragments distally. So ideally, I would treat these with plating. Haranson reported a complication rate of about 83% with external coapsation alone. The complication rate with plating in one study was about 34%. There's a study that looks at the use of tea plates, which I think are very useful. All those fractures healed, but there was a reduction in carpal flexion. And I think locking plates have made a big difference to purchase in the limited bone stock we have. Just get rid of that arrow. An example here of a fracture in the radius and ulna. And this one was treated with a T-plate. This is non-locking. You can see pretty good reduction here in the radius and ulna. I would try and compress these fractures if at all possible, or if I'm using a locking plate, a sort of hybrid type approach with maybe two locking screws distally, and then try and use one of these screws to compress against those locking screws. This case had a delayed union. There may have been some infection here, but you can see loosening of these implants. And this can be a real problem because the size of the implants you're using, if the fracture doesn't heal, they're subject to continued loading, which probably really doesn't help with screw loosening and fatigue failure of the implants. We treated that case with low intensity pulsed ultrasound for a further 6 weeks, which did actually help and promote healing. We never got a positive culture in this dog to indicate that there was ongoing effect. It's a 10-month Italian Greyhound with actually a reasonably nice radius and ulna fracture because it's not too distal. So we treated this with a locking plate, and actually there was plenty of room at the bottom. So a sort of long plate was placed spanning the fracture, and there was reasonable room to get three screws distal to it. One of the problems with these dogs is their size means that you can only use small implants, which are more susceptible to fatigue failure. In this case, we sort of went for a less stiff construct to try and promote healing, but unfortunately, that reduced in fatigue failure of the implant over the fracture site, and we needed to revise that case. I was replated. Again, I'm not sure how clear this one comes out actually, but one of the other things we see sometimes with these dogs is when you've plated them, so this dog's original fracture is at this level here, but you can see a stress riser is developed at the top of the plate around this screw hole here, and this dog is refractured proximal to the plate. This is a dog, if you look closely at the x-rays, it looks like the same fracture, but this actually presented with bilateral fractures to the left and right leg at the same time after a fall from height, and both those were plated. So tips I would have for those dogs, they're tricky fractures. I think T-plates are very helpful because you can get sort of more screws distal to the fracture. The use of locking and hybrid plates, or locking plates placed in a hybrid fashion, so two locking screws distally and then compressing the fracture proximally. I think compression really helps. If you can get some load sharing between the implants and the bone, I think that helps healing. Reducing these fractures, holding them in reduction while you plate them, I think can be difficult, getting your reduction forceps across them because it's a very small bone and the fractures are often quite transverse. So what I will often do is reduce the fracture, have a look at where the plate fits, and then sort of not attempt to hold the fracture in reduction, fix the plate distally, and then apply some screws proximally. And I would use a bone graft in most of these cases unless they're very young. There's also a study by Bolzer that shows using a friamental graft promotes healing in these fractures. So they showed healing at 70 days with an amental graft compared to 100 days without. One of the final couple of things just to flip through as presenting things for these small breed dogs. Always think about immune-mediated joint disease. It's pretty common. The history, then there's normally some pyrexia and a shifting lameness. You can see a high number of neutrophils on this slide, cytology of synovial fluid. And we do see some of these dogs with immune-mediated joint disease sort of presenting with concurrent ligament degeneration, so a sort of immune-mediated weakening of ligaments, so they end up sort of palmar grade and plantar grade. Final thing, topical at the moment, but in some of these small breed dogs, brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome is always a consideration and something that makes managing some of these patients tricky. Our final friend, the Cavalier, Chiari malformation causing syringa hydromyelia. Whilst not the most common presentation, I have seen dogs presenting with isolated thoracic limb lameness, with this being their only finding. So in dogs with neck pain or lameness and pain of unknown origin, for a Cavalier, always consider an MRI scan of the neck. So a bit of a whistle-stop tour of things you might see with small and toy breed dogs, and hopefully some tips on treating them. Certainly not by any means a comprehensive review of all the things you might see, but hopefully there's some useful points in there. If you have any questions when you review this talk, feel free to get in touch. For those who aren't online at the moment, once again, thanks for tuning in to the webinar. I know we've got one question now, which I'll answer via the window. Thanks very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Mark for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.